This dynasty marks a period of wealth and splendour, and its monarchs were obsessed by such a passion for making monuments for themselves as no men have ever before or since had a chance to display and gratify. It was Cheops and Chephren and Mykerinus of this fourth dynasty who raised the vast piles of the great and the second and the third pyramids at Giza. These unmeaning sepulchral piles of an almost incredible vastness, erected in an age when engineering science had scarcely begun, exhausted the resources of Egypt through three long reigns, and left her wasted as if by a war. The story of Egypt from the 4th to the 15th dynasty is a story of conflicts between alternative capitals and competing religions, of separations into several kingdoms and reunions. It is, so to speak, an internal history. Here we can name only one of that long series of pharaohs, Pepi II, who reigned 90 years, the longest reign in history, and left a great abundance of inscriptions and buildings. At last, there happened to Egypt what happened so frequently to the civilizations of Mesopotamia. Egypt was conquered by nomadic Semites, who founded a shepherd dynasty, the Hyksos, 16th dynasty, which was finally expelled by native Egyptians. This invasion probably happened while that first Babylonian empire, which Hammurabi founded, was flourishing, but the exact correspondence of dates between early Egypt and Babylonia are still very doubtful. Only after a long period of servitude did a popular uprising expel these foreigners again. After the War of Liberation, about 1600 BC, there followed a period of great prosperity in Egypt, the New Empire. Egypt became a great and united military state, and pushed her expeditions at last as far as the Euphrates, and so the age-long struggle between the Egyptian and Babylonian Assyrian power began. For a time, Egypt was the ascendant power. Thutmose III and Amenophis III, the 18th dynasty, ruled from Ethiopia to the Euphrates in the 15th century BC. For various reasons, these names stand out with unusual distinctness in the Egyptian record. They were great builders, and left many monuments and inscriptions. Amenophis III founded Luxor, and added greatly to Karnak. At Tel el Amarna, a mass of letters has been found, the royal correspondence with Babylonian and Hittite and other monarchs, including that Tushratta who took Nineveh, throwing a flood of light upon the political and social affairs of this particular age. Of Amenophis IV, we shall have more to tell later, but of one, the most extraordinary and able of Egyptian monarchs, Queen Hatasu, we have no space to tell. She's represented upon her monuments in masculine garb and with a long beard as a symbol of wisdom. Thereafter, there was a brief Syrian conquest of Egypt, a series of changing dynasties, among which we may note the 19th, which included Ramses II, a great builder of temples, who reigned 77 years, about 1317 to 1250 BC, and who's supposed by some to have been the pharaoh of Moses, and the 22nd, which included Shishak, who plundered Solomon's temple about 930 BC. An Ethiopian conqueror from the Upper Nile founded the 25th dynasty, a foreign dynasty, which went down 670 BC before the new Assyrian empire created by Tiglath-Pileser III, Sargon II, and Sennacherib, of which we've already made mention. The days of any Egyptian predominance over foreign nations were drawing to an end. For a time, under Psammaticus I, of the 26th dynasty, 664 to 610 BC, native rule was restored, and Necho II recovered for a time the old Egyptian possessions in Syria up to the Euphrates, while the Medes and Chaldeans were attacking Nineveh. From those gains, Necho II was routed out again after the fall of Nineveh and the Assyrians by Nebuchadnezzar II, the great Chaldean king, the Nebuchadnezzar of the Bible. The Jews, who had been the allies of Necho II, were taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. When, in the 6th century BC, Chaldea fell to the Persians, Egypt followed suit. A rebellion later made Egypt independent once more for 60 years, and in 332 BC she welcomed Alexander the Great as her conqueror, to be ruled thereafter by foreigners, first by Greeks, then by Romans, then in succession by Arabs, Turks, and British, until the present day. Such, briefly, is the history of Egypt from its beginnings, a history first of isolation, and then of increasing entanglement with the affairs of other nations, as increasing facilities of communication drew the peoples of the world into closer and closer interaction. Fourth, the history we need to tell here of India is simpler even than this brief record of Egypt. The Dravidian peoples in the Ganges Valley developed upon parallel lines to the Sumerian and Egyptian societies, but it's doubtful if they ever got to a so high a stage of social development. They've left few monuments, and they never achieved any form of writing. Somewhere about the time of Hammurabi or later, a branch of the Aryan-speaking people who then occupied North Persia and Afghanistan pushed down the northwest passes into India. They conquered their way until they prevailed over all the darker populations of North India and spread their rule or influence over the whole peninsula. They never achieved any unity in India. Their history is a history of warring kings and republics. The Persian Empire, in the days of its expansion after the capture of Babylon, pushed its boundaries beyond the Indus, and later Alexander the Great marched as far as the border of the desert that separates the Punjab from the Ganges Valley. But with this bare statement, we will, for a time, leave the history of India. Fifth. Meanwhile, as this triple system of white man civilization developed in India and in the lands about the meeting places of Asia, Africa, and Europe, another and quite distinct civilization was developing and spreading out from the then fertile but now dry and desolate valley of the Tarim and from the slopes of the Kuin Lun Mountains in two directions down the course of the Huang Ho and later into the valley of the Yangtze Kiang. We know practically nothing as yet of the archaeology of China. We don't know anything of the Stone Age in that part of the world, and at present our ideas of this early civilization derived from the still very imperfectly explored Chinese literature. It's evidently been from the first and throughout a Mongolian civilization. Until after the time of Alexander the Great, there are few traces of any Aryan or Semitic, much less of Hamitic influence. All such influences were still in another world, separated by mountains, deserts, and wild nomadic tribes until that time. The Chinese seem to have made their civilization spontaneously and unassisted. Some recent writers suppose, indeed, a connection with ancient Sumeria. Of course, both China and Sumeria arose on the basis of the almost worldwide early Neolithic culture. But the Tarim Valley and the lower Euphrates are separated by such vast obstacles of mountain and desert as to forbid the idea of any migration or interchange of peoples who had once settled down. Perhaps the movement from the north met another movement of culture coming from the south. Though the civilization of China is wholly Mongolian, as we've defined Mongolian, it doesn't follow that the northern roots are the only ones from which it grew. If it grew first in the Tarim Valley, then unlike all other civilizations, including the Mexican and Peruvian, it didn't grow out of the Heliolithic culture. We Europeans know very little as yet of the ethnology and prehistory of southern China. There the Chinese mingle with such kindred peoples as the Siamese and Burmese, and seem to bridge over towards the darker Dravidian peoples and towards the Malays. It's quite clear from the Chinese records that there were southern as well as northern beginnings of a civilization, and that the Chinese civilization that comes into history 2,000 years B.C. is the result of a long process of conflicts, minglings, and interchanges between a southern and a northern culture, of which the southern may have been the earlier and more highly developed. The southern Chinese perhaps played the role towards the northern Chinese that the Hamites or Sumerians played to the Aryan and Semitic peoples in the west, or that the settled Dravidians played towards the Aryans in India. They may have been the first agriculturalists and the first temple builders, but so little is known as yet of this attractive chapter in prehistory that we can't dwell upon it further here. The chief foreigners mentioned in the early annals of China were a Ural-Altaic people on the northeast frontier, the Huns, against whom certain of the earlier emperors made war. Chinese history is still very little known to European students, and our accounts of the early records are particularly unsatisfactory.